Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Thursday, October 24th. Today marks a month since the hotel union workers began a strike against the Hilton Hawaiian chain. We check in with Local 5. On the cutting edge of science, a local company, Oceanit, breaks into new territory with a $1 million grant to develop organoids. We check in on the longline fishing industry. Will fishing go the way of coffee and macadamia nuts? We talk labeling. And know someone who is hypersensitive to sound? Consider this novel idea, a concert for the neurodivergent happening this weekend. We get a preview. Tune to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. It has been a month since 1,800 hotel workers walked off the job at Hilton Hawaiian Village Waikiki Beach Resort. We connected with union leader Kate Watanabe earlier today. He's the Unite Here Local 5 financial secretary and treasurer who's out on the picket line this morning.
We have a number of members of the clergy community that are coming out to the line and doing a blessing and a vigil to help support our members. And we've just seen an outpouring of support, Catherine, really over the last week and a half as our message about our campaign continues to get out there. Last week, we had the governor, you know, commit and say publicly that he's not going to cross any picket line. He canceled an event he was supposed to appear at on Saturday. We had the lieutenant governor come search out our Hilton strikers at the Pride Parade to express our support. You know, we met with the council chair. So all of that has been tremendously helpful. We had a large event. HMSA moved a 1,400-person event from the Hilton Hawaiian Village that was scheduled for here later this week and instead moved their event out of respect of the workers in our picket line. So there's been a tremendous outpouring of community and political support from our local community. And the guests, continue to come out to our picket lines and support our campaign. But it's been tough. It's been a struggle. We're 1 month in. We have no confirmed bargaining dates as of yet, although our communication and our conversation with Hilton and the rest of our employers throughout Waikiki remains an open line of communication. It's really on our employers. We've provided our employers with a comprehensive settlement package that will help us resolve the current strike at the Hilton so that we can get back to work and do what we love most, right, which is providing the quality experience to our guests that come to Hawaii to begin with.
I understand that there was another strike that went more than a month. I believe it was in California. And that one, I think, also against Hilton. And that one has been resolved.
That's correct. You know, in 2024, our union, our international union, Unite Here, I'm proud to say that I'm the co-chair of our national campaign alongside my counterpart, Carlos Armayo from Local 26 in Boston. And together, between our two locals, as well as locals in San Francisco and San Diego and San Jose and all across the country, have been part of a national coalition to try to address the issues that are affecting hotel workers in each and every one of our markets. And yes, there have been important key settlements for some markets. Hilton workers at the San Diego Bayfront were on strike for 38 days until they ratified and settled on a new contract, which met their goals that they had put on the bargaining table. We saw earlier settlements, Catherine, in smaller cities and markets like Providence and New Haven and Greenwich. And we expect more settlements to come towards workers' way in the coming weeks. And we know that at some point it'll be Hawaii's time as well. But until we get there, we're doing what we know we have to do, which is continue to make sure that we support our members as we sort of turn the page into the second month. We've had our first large food distribution that the Hawaii State AFL-CIO in partnership with the Hawaii Food Bank put on for our striking workers on Monday. We have another one set for next week, Monday. So those are the kinds of things that we're starting to really focus in on as members embark on the second month of the strike.
And I understand that the union is also going to be soon launching hardship fund.
That's correct. You know, part of the support, the outpouring of support that we've gotten from our own local community, our community within our own international union, is the generosity of our own members who have donated money from their pocket to support striking hotel workers. So we have a Local 5 hardship fund where we've raised a good amount of money that will be available to striking workers who are under extreme hardship, who are at threat of not being able to cover the basic necessities that we all need to pay for, utilities and rent or their mortgage. And so we have a committee of other Local 5 workers that are sorting through applications, and that's something specific and available to the existing striking workers here at the village should they need that extra assistance.
I recall talking to one worker who said that, you know, her mother was a housekeeper, her brother was in catering, and her sister also worked for Hilton. They all worked for Hilton, and
That's right.
All lived in one house in Kalihi, and that's going to be really difficult for that family.
That's correct. And, you know, we have many, many families like that, husband and wife, and entire families like you just mentioned, who have found meaningful, gainful employment here at the Hawaiian Village. And that's why we're out here, so that we can continue to make sure that we have good, stable, long-term jobs that can sustain ourselves and our families. But yes, each and every one of our members who've been out for the last 31 days know that it's a huge sacrifice. But at the end of the day, it's a sacrifice that is temporary, in the sense that there's more at stake than just the loss of work over the last 31 days. It's really about the future of tourism and our ability to have good jobs so that our kids, if they choose to work for them, have that ability to find meaningful employment as well.
And the sticking points remain the wages and the reinstatement of services that were cut prior to the pandemic?
Yeah, there really are. It's a good point. And yes, since April of this year, when we started to meet with all of our major employers, Hilton, Hyatt, Kilia, and Marriott, the two major goals that our membership outlined for our employers is, one, wages and enough money to secure our benefits, but wages that help us get ahead, not just get by, but also a meaningful commitment from our employers that our ability or our willingness to show up every day to work to make our hotels profitable and successful is recognized and acknowledged and comes with a real commitment that we're worth something. And those issues relate to issues of respect, but also go directly related to workload and staffing that have a direct correlation to quality of guest service. So absolutely. One of the things that our members have asked for is that should we encounter or be put in a situation that was similar coming out of the pandemic, where it is a major industry impact or an emergency order has been established, similar to 9/11 or on Maui with the Lahaina wildfires, and that we all experienced during COVID, that should there be unilateral changes that our employers make that directly impact our workforce and our ability to provide that service, we want to make sure that workers aren't left behind. We want to make sure that workers have the ability to work with our employers to make the adjustments necessary to make our hotel successful. We want to have a seat at the table. That's a meaningful commitment that we're looking for in this session, and we have not yet gotten that. We want to make sure that if our hotel industry continues to cut services, which result in the combination of jobs, which we've seen year over year since the pandemic and even before the pandemic, that workers have the ability to know that if they should be laid off, that they have a guaranteed commitment from the employer related to severance, for instance, that their 20 years, 25, 30 years of service is not going to be for nothing. So those are the kinds of things, in addition to improving our workload and staffing language in our contract, that have been a priority since day one when we started to meet with our employers on April 24th this year. Those are the two major areas that we're trying to address this year.
And this strike is impacting the timeshares as well. What are you hearing on that front?
Well, you know, Hilton Grand Vacations basically retains Hilton employees. These are separate companies. I think people may not realize that. The Hilton Grand Vacations, which is a timeshare outfit, is a separate entity and company from Hilton Hotels. But our members that are employees of Hilton service the timeshare towers. So the same level of service that is not being had at the hotel towers are also not being done at the timeshare towers as well.
That was Kate Watanabe of the Hotel Workers Union, Unite Here Local 5, talking to us this morning from the picket line as we mark 1 year of the strike against the Hilton Hawaiian Village, which also impacts the Hilton timeshare towers as well. We did reach out to management, but have not heard back yet. Organoids. Sounds a bit sci-fi, but a homegrown company is pushing the envelope into the scientific world of medical research. Oceanit has just been awarded a $4 million grant to develop mini organs grown in the lab to study our lymphatic system. It hopes to unlock better treatments for the diseases that ail us all, as well as, you know, things like cancer and genetic disorders. Oceanit President and CEO Patrick Sullivan explains this new direction.
Let me start with the broader thing that we're doing at Oceanit. We've got about a dozen different programs we're putting together on devices and therapies. And this one is really interesting because an organoid is a synthetic organ, which isn't built to be installed in a human, but is an incredible device for testing so that you're not sacrificing animals unduly. And so you can rapidly test lots of things, and you can do this in an automated way. So you can use robotics. Once you build them, and you could build tons of them, you can have robots do all kinds of things to inject and test and measure. So it's taking the cost to sort out the effectiveness and some of the side effects of a therapy. It really changes the whole cost structure. So we have a version of this organoid. Looks like a three-dimensional, like a Rubik's Cube. And you can build each cube, each part of the cube, each little bucket in the cube is a test site. And so you can just rapidly crank through all kinds of things.
So it's organ tissue, and you basically are then on like what, hyperspeed to be able to figure out,
right,
is this therapy going to work or is that one better suited?
Right. We can expose the same organ over and over and over to all kinds of things. So if you think about it, you know, how does it like salt? How does it like sugar? How does it like, you know, how does it respond to all of these things? So you can say, okay, this one looks pretty good. Let's say you're working on managing, I don't know, something like inflammation. So you can expose it to something. You know, on the Big Island, they've got antaxanthin, the algae, which has got great anti-inflammatory qualities. Expose it to that and watch it perform. And then look at it perform under other conditions and see. That's just under inflammation, which I think a lot of people now, if you're a runner or something, your knees are stiff and sore, that's inflammation speaking to you. And when you get older, it gets worse. And so managing it becomes a bigger deal. In our case, we're focused on the lymphatic system. And it's kind of the last frontier on managing these really complicated diseases. And what the program we're working with in the government, so to give you a little context there, ARPA-H is Advanced Research Project Agency for Healthcare. And ARPA-H got started because National Institutes of Health, which I would estimate today has got about $70 billion a year for research, has become, in my opinion, in the opinion of a lot of people, very conservative. And what they do is they do kind of work on the margins, they polish the rock, they do something they kind of already know will work, keeps a lot of people in the labs.
They play it safe.
They play it very safe. So this program is really focused on swing for the bleachers. And if you're not going to swing for the bleachers, it's not the place to go. But if you do and it works, then, you know, potentially could have a huge impact.
Right. And you get the home run, you get a faster cure for some of these diseases.
Well, the way to think about it, I mean, of course, there's all kinds of terrible diseases we really don't understand. But if you kind of step back in time and look at the concept of national healthcare, Obamacare. So in order for it to really be effective, you've got to drive the cost down and increase the effectiveness, which sound almost contradictory. That's the idea of where disruptive technology comes in. So something that disrupts the status quo could potentially change the industry and reduce cost. So a way to think of that is in the area of computing. So used to be IBM was the dominant computing platform. They had these massive machines. They were called Big Blue. And everything had to be done in these massive centers. And today you have a phone with more computation in the phone than you had in most of these centers. And what's interesting is it's cheap, it's very personal, and it's just for you. So it's a very personalized, high capability very inexpensive technology, and that's where people are trying to drive healthcare. That's going to happen from programs like ARPA-H.
Okay, so it's something that's willing to take more risks.
Way more risk. Yeah, so they'll try things that will sound crazy. And I was just meeting 2 weeks ago with the DARPA director in Washington, D.C., and I was telling her that we had proposed a few years back, because they've been kind of the agency to take these big swings. And I said, you know, you guys took a chance on this insane idea of causality in biology. This is before the pandemic. You know, we were working on this human-style AI. And we came up with this theory about how genetics may, the way to understand it, we may want to use a model that is based on linguistics and see if we can actually make sense of it. At that time, after several years, and they funded this, we produced a tool set called the Grammar of RNA that gave us a tool set to design molecules that's really unique, but it's based on linguistics applied to genetics. So DARPA took a wild swing on that one, but we actually nailed it and produced a very usable tool, which we're trying to use now with Cancer Research Center and collaborating with Queens on new therapies. For example, we're looking at a double negative breast cancer as a candidate. But point is, there's these programs that are willing to take big risk, and that's where we've been focusing. Well, first, we're not really built to polish the, you know, the rock over and over. But it's important that we do keep these medical research centers occupied and employ very bright people. But to push healthcare, to really change and impact people, we need to be taking much bigger risks. And that's where back to organoids, right? Because it's potentially, it's highly risky, but the impact would be huge. And the lymphatic system is something that we kind of know it's there, it's important, but we don't know a lot about it. And there are certain things where it affects people, and there's some program people we've met and some researchers we've met at different university centers and hospitals where, you know, this could make a huge difference in managing and understanding disease.
By taking then this step, getting this funding and really pushing through this idea, I mean, we really could fast forward, you know, solving the mystery behind these diseases that are affecting our organs.
Right. And our human health. You can have organs that are not used properly or being overused or starting to fail. You've got everything in the middle of what can be going on. And it'd be best if you could keep your organ and kind of get it tuned up. But to do that, you don't want to experiment on yourself. It'd be better if you could have an organoid built for you, be just for your organ or organs, where you can test it out and say, okay, well, let's try some of these and some of those. And those are all done in a very thoughtful way. It's not random. But to be able to look at what the outcome would be as opposed to getting really sick. So the tradition in medicine for looking at therapies, once you do the what they call animal models, so we take rats and expose them and maybe pigs and we expose them and we do different things. But at some point, you do human trials. Right. So epidemiology, let's have 1 million people smoke cigarettes and 1 million people don't. And let's all get together in 30 years, figure out who's alive and who's not. And that's how it's done today. We think that that is an outdated idea, that this could be a much better idea, but it's very specific. So you can look at your organ or your physiology and exposure or tested with a particular therapy optimized for you, designed for you. And you can check it out and see how it's going to work before you take it. So this creates kind of a new category for managing disease and developing therapies, because everybody may be a little different to it, because a lot of medicine is built around one size, you know, fits all. Let's everybody take the same thing, regardless of the fact that it may affect you different than it does me. We all just take the same thing because that's how we're, you know, that's what we do. We think we can do a lot better than that. But again, it has to be cost effective. This goes right to the cost question, too.
His company's been awarded a $4 million grant to do work with organoids or lab-grown miniature organs in hopes of developing more effective medical therapies. It's pretty wild research to some. We wondered if it was difficult getting doctors to do this type of research.
There's not as many as we'd like, but we do find them. And it's the kind of people that went into medicine with the idea they're going to make a big difference, but they get in it and then they keep doing kind of the same thing over and over. Nothing changes. So there's a level of frustration. So we're finding people that are saying, okay, enough. They may continue with part of their practice, but they're really motivated to try something new, especially something that could bust through these problems. It's an interesting challenge because a lot of them can make good money just doing what general doctors do or specializing in one particular area, but we are finding those people. And what we're trying to do here with the new director of the Cancer Research Center, a great guy, came from MD Anderson, tend to be very collaborative. So there's a combination of research, clinical, and teaching. And when I've worked with folks at the Texas Medical Center there in Houston, a lot of them are like that. And they're kind of drawn to that idea. They like to work with patients, but they're very interested in research and they're very interested in the latest and the cutting edge. And so ultimately here in Hawaii, we think that that's where we need to go so that Hawaii, if we ever want to attract, you know, you hear people talk about medical tourism and that kind of thing, it's because we've got to be at the edge of a science that deals directly to medicine and impacts humans.
And then are there ethical considerations when you do this tissue research and create these organoids?
Well, given today's political environment, that's kind of an interesting question. In my view, this is a great way to manage any ethical issues around animal trials, whether you like rats or not, or mice. I think in this way, you can be very specific to the individual you're trying to develop it for, and may find out that, you know, maybe there's 5 or 10 categories of this particular organ or this particular organ condition, whatever that might be. But as opposed to slaughtering a bunch of animals, you're able to do it in a different way.
And so where do you get the tissue? Just from the subject matter themselves?
Yes, but it's interesting how we're doing it. So this will sound maybe a little bit kind of wacky, but at OceanIT, because we do a variety of technologies, but the material, the base material that we're using and some of the science around it applies in other fields as well. So although we're culturing an organ and growing an organ basically with essentially, you can imagine like printing an organ, some of the same techniques we've used in the energy industry and other places too. So fundamentally, we've got these interesting gels that we've developed. Well, for example, I think we can talk about this rapid wound management, things that will help with, you know, replacing joints and knees so they're biocompatible. We've developed gels we've got a really cool program, which is like, it's a tattoo, but it's a sensor and it actually comes in a gel, but it's computational. So we built a computer in a gel that you put in the side of your shoulder that lights up when you see a chemical. So we're building all kinds of weird stuff, and it's in different fields. In this case, it's very specific to understanding impact on organs and for human health.
So it's kind of neutral, and you can build it, as opposed to getting tissue from a person, from Patrick.
Yeah, you might need some cells or things to get started with because you want to get it right. But it's not like you're harvesting something so much as you're just maybe taking a little bit of sample. So you get the code and build it from there.
So I understand now why you're really excited about where this could lead.
Oh, yeah. It's got huge potential. And this particular problem on the lymphatic system is one of the hardest problems, but that's kind of what we do. And then what happens is we'll do this, and in the process, we'll kind of learn about how to use it in a variety of other areas. And so you've got a friend of mine passed away from a kidney failure. So wouldn't it be nice if you could use this kind of technique to solve that problem, right? To kind of regrow a kidney or to basically provide unique therapy to enable the kidney to regrow itself, which, you know, these sound like really hard things to do, but I think we don't have the requisite knowledge yet, but the tools we're putting together, we think, will enable this in the future. And Just to give you one more example of something we're working on, but I mentioned the computational thing in the tattoo, but you can do the same thing. It's basically a therapy that you might, let's just assume you take a pill. When the pill goes into your system, it actually is sending these, it's not Bill Gates looking at what you're thinking. These are like biocomputational systems. And as they work through your system, they're looking for things and they're making calculations, and they're going after things based on the code you put into the system. So if you're looking at a diseased organ or part of the body that's diseased, you may not understand what's going on inside the person, but you can write code so that when it finds it, it can sort it out and know what to do. So we're literally building that stuff now, which is really cool. It sounds a little scary, but see, it sort of changes the idea around traditional concepts in invasive surgery, like, well, let's cut you open,
see what's there,
and then good luck feeling better, as opposed to, we understand, you know, these are the 10 things that could be going on, this is what we think, and we've written some code that says how to sort through that to get to what we're trying to do, which is deliver this therapy in your cell to get you mended.
So you can narrow down
right. With
precision about what
exactly. So it's not, you're not carpet bombing. You're not saying, well, let's carpet bomb 10 different problems. Let's focus on one, but build the computation so we can do it on the fly as it's going through your body.
Okay. So you just got this funding. And when do you start?
We've already started playing with it. Well, I say playing with it. I mean, we're, as these things go, we normally have to kind of build it and just kind of see what's up with it. It's like you make something and you try it out, you do different things to it, you experiment with it just in the beginning because you're trying to look at the limits of your own thinking of what you think is possible, what it's going to do. So it's not really playing with it, but it sort of is kind of like that. So it's kind of like, wow, this is really cool. Let's see what happens here. Let's see what happens there. So we create time and programs where we encourage people to do things. And the first step is what I refer to as the toy science. It's kind of like, why is this really cool? And how do I break it? And how do I not break it? Those are really important questions when you're on the edge of science. And so, people that like this, it's a lot of fun too.
Cutting edge, and who knows where it's going to take us.
Absolutely. But okay. I'm an optimist. And so whenever we do this kind of stuff, I'm sure there'll be some really cool outcomes. We just don't know what they are yet.
Ah, the possibilities. We have been picking Patrick Sullivan's brain about the groundbreaking research that his company OceanIt is involved in. The head of the University of Hawaii Cancer Center that Sullivan referenced in recent collaborations happens to be Dr. Naoto Ueno, who has been at the helm for the past year after a long run at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. We plan to sit down and have a conversation with him next week.
The news and music you hear on HPR are supported by local organizations reaching you with their message and making a difference every day. Mahalo to Leeward Theater at Leeward Community College, Keiki Kaukau, and to Best Press. They believe, just as you do, in the power of public radio. See a full list of our sponsors at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Younger workers in Portugal are leaving the country in droves. High rents and low wages are pushing them out. The government introduced new tax breaks to get them to stay, but...
To be honest, these measures are coming a little bit too late. If they really want to fix the country, they have a long road ahead.
Brain drain in Portugal, that's next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
HPR's Mark Liddell has been spending time at Honolulu's docks and has been reporting on a developing situation with Hawaii's long-line fishermen. They're raising concerns about labeling. Do you know where your fish comes from? Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Catherine. How are you?
Good, good. And so, yeah, what did you find when you were out there?
Yeah, so I, like you mentioned, I spent some time out at the Pier 38, where the Honolulu Fish Auction is and where a lot of the Hawaii longline, or commercial longline boats are. And I was talking to some people because I had learned that there was some issue with the fishermen getting paid. And something that I had found out when talking to a bunch of people in the industry was this issue about imports. Foreign imported fish is a kind of a big issue and a long-standing one in the industry. And tied to that is labeling. The issue is that there's a mix of locally caught tuna, a big eye or yellowfin, and imported from these other countries or elsewhere that's not Hawaii caught. And because there's a federal law to distinguish which of that fish and other products like beef and pork, which country they came from. But that law sort of falls apart once you add ingredients to it. So and a big one here that a lot of the fishers have talked about is like poke. So you can have poke at the supermarket, but it's hard to tell if it's locally caught or foreign imported. And so basically the story that I'm working on, this is something that's going to come out soon on HBR, is there are some calls to improve the labeling for that fish so that consumers will know if it's imported or if it was caught by one of these local fishing boats. But yeah, that's basically what the story is. And if you remember, there were a couple of state laws that were passed this year at the state legislature to do a similar thing. They would protect coffee farmers and consumers and macadamia nut farmers and consumers by requiring packages sold here to have labels indicating if all of the product is local or if it has like imported product on it. And yeah, so that's kind of the story that's coming out.
And so who did you talk to?
The first person I talked to about this is Eric Kingma. He is the executive director for the Hawaii Longline Association. And he talks, and I remember I was talking to him and he said a little bit about how it's unfair to the consumers and the fishers that there isn't this labeling in process.
This fishery is our fishery. It's Feeding Hawaii. It's the number one largest food producer in the state. It's highly regulated and monitored, but we are competing in an open market that is not all that fair. And the ads campaigns for consumers are not all that factual, or they're just not, they're missing a pretty important piece of the information that consumers can choose from. Why is it that my shirt has to have the origin, but my ahi poke doesn't?
Yeah, and he makes a good point, because I kind of steer clear of stuff that isn't fresh, you know, because you don't know if it's been treated, right, by that carbon dioxide.
Yeah, that's another thing. Some folks talked about how there's less quality control from foreign imported fish, and that includes, yeah, being treated with carbon dioxide, which you can do with frozen fish sort of color it to make it look like
it's fresh.
It's more fresh. And that one, there's like sometimes there could be like a safety issue, but it also kind of tarnishes the brand for locally caught fish. So that's another reason why branding is kind of a big deal. And probably the biggest thing that both fishers and though like their advocates kind of want done on the local level.
And so, gosh, I mean, there's a lot of fish that we consume here in Hawaii, but a lot of it is not from our waters.
Yeah, so you know, I'm looking into the numbers, and I believe a little more than half of all the seafood in Hawaii is imported. And I was looking at the pelagic fish, so that includes the tuna, and it's a little lower, but there's still some of that import that needs to come in to fill the local market, I guess, local demand. I guess back up a little bit, the way I found out about all of this going on is it's through an online post. It's actually on the Hawaii subreddit. There was a post mentioning sort of the troubles at the fish auction. So that prompted me to go down. I actually talked with some of the fishers out there, some of the longline fishers. What really got me, I guess, going in the story is they were describing how tough it is for them to survive because...
Everything's going up, right? The price of fuel, I can see
that.
Yeah,
and I think a big thing is that inflation has doubled, even tripled maybe the cost of a fishing trip, and that's kind of prompting some of the fishermen to think about reconsidering their careers. One of the people I talked to was Troy Pack. He's the captain of the longline fishing boat called the Itasca, and that's based out of Oahu.
I just got in and sold my fish, and I didn't make enough to pay my own bills, so the boss advanced me some so I could pay my bills. And now I got to turn around and go back out to sea and hope to God that maybe I come in and make a paycheck. Like, dude, it's not even worth it. I love fishing, and I don't really know much else. And I live here. I've been here. I have all my stuff here. I don't really want to leave and go fishing anywhere else. So I'm kind of stuck here doing it, you know?
Yeah, it's tough for them.
Yeah, and these are people. And Troy Pack, who you just heard, he's been fishing for like half his life. And now to hear him considering leaving, I think is sort of a testament to how tough it is for the fishers. The fish prices have, they tend to fluctuate for a variety of reasons, supply and demand. Some of this is seasonal, and some of it is almost random, but there's a lot of fluctuation in the prices that they get their fish for. The bottom line is that the prices of that fish that the fishers get hasn't changed all that much in like 3 or 4 decades.
Yeah, so it's pretty flat.
Yeah.
For the most part, yeah.
And, which wouldn't be a problem if inflation and the cost of a fishing trip wasn't so high. That is a problem. And I had talked to another person, Peter Webster, and he had mentioned that it's a problem for him to go fishing.
The prices of fish have gotten better in the past, say, 30 years or whatever. I mean, they have increased across the boards. I don't mean to sound like a total negative entity or whatever, but they're not up to the standards of everything else, so to speak. You know what I mean? I mean, for us, 30 years ago, we were looking for a $4 average on the load average, you know? And still, that's the same deal we're looking for now. I mean, it's $4. Of course, we'd like to get the $6 or $7 that we can really profit off of, but we still struggle to get $4 a lot of times, and that's really super frustrating because the price of the trips have gone up.
Yeah, so I guess we'll have to see how they remedy this, right? With legislation or?
Yeah, and I'll have a couple of stories on that coming up.
Okay, all right. Well, thank you so much, Mark. We have been talking to HPR's Mark Liddell, who's spending time at the Honolulu docks. We will have additional stories on this in the weeks to come.
Age and income don't matter when it comes to supporting HPR. Whether you are 23 or 83, you can make a meaningful gift to HPR through your will, trust, or other estate plan. You can even name the station as a beneficiary of a life insurance policy or retirement plan. And when you do, let us know so we can recognize you in our legacy society. Learn more and get started at hawaiipublicradio.org/legacy.
Donald Trump says if he's elected, he'll deport millions of people.
The Republican platform promises to launch the largest deportation operation in the history of our country.
Critics say the plan is inhumane.
What he's proposing strikes me as uniquely disproportionate, harsh, and probably illegal.
What is Trump's plan and what are the consequences? That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
When we go to concerts, many of us expect music at very low volumes and an audience with lots of energy. But those kinds of settings often exclude the neurodivergent, people whose brains process information and stimuli differently. It includes people with autism and ADHD, and that's the reason behind the upcoming Color event on Oahu. It's a disability-inclusive event featuring painting sessions, but also includes a curated neurodivergent cautious concert. The Conversation's Russell Subiano sat down in our studios with the organizers, Jackie Pereira, who's a neurodivergent child, and musician Kelsey Armstrong.
The event aims to include people who are neurodivergent.
Yes. Right?
And from what I've been able to read, a neurodivergent person is someone whose brain processes information in a different way. You've shared that you have a neurodivergent child. Can you share your understanding of neurodivergence?
Yeah, fully. That's fully the inspiration behind this event. So there's like a meme that says like a family does not pop out a single autist. And that's 100% true. Like I fully did not realize that I was autistic until I had my daughter. Like I just said, it was 10 years of being uncomfortable in social situations and not really understanding what was exactly making me uncomfortable, because I am a super social person. I'm actually like on the scale of like the more extroverted social autistic person. But in observing my daughter from truly like toddlerhood, it was so obvious that like she has autism because we would be around kids of similar ages. So it was easy to see like the differences in certain milestones. And okay, so like I said, I'm a social person, so I would try to bring my daughter with me to certain things, like very chill events, like day markets that are not that crowded. And even at those, it would be like booming sound, like just the most top volume, can't escape. Like I already have my daughter in headphones and she wants to leave, you know? So I was just like, I just don't really feel like this is necessary. I feel like with just some input, because, you know, like you said, you really only looked it up because we're talking today, which is pretty common. Yeah. That's pretty like every day. Like a lot of my, in raising Bunny, my daughter, is educating others. Yeah. And so that's another reason why I wanted to have this event be like really emphasize that you are welcomed, because there's just so many events where you're completely not considered. You can't assume that you will be. So putting it like on the flyer especially was super important. So in organizing the sound, because my daughter loves music, it's not like she doesn't love music. She loves singing. So in talking to Kelsey, so I already know that Kelsey's ADHD, which is a combination of autism and ADHD. I knew that I could bring this idea to Kelsey and Kelsey would understand the like importance of what I was trying to do and has like experienced similar things, if not more so, because Kelsey's like front and center being a performer.
I think a lot of people, you know, they buy tickets to concerts, they go to concerts, they go to music festivals and shows, and I don't think that they really think about who can't go to these types of settings, right?
Yeah.
So I think that's what's so interesting to me. And so I did want to ask you, Kelsey, when the flyer says that there is curated, divergent,
neurodivergent, cautious.
Yeah. What does that sound like?
Okay, well, before I get into that, I just want to say that, like, how people experience neurodivergence when it comes to, like, their limits with sensory inputs and outputs, it varies very much, like, just depending on the person. So, like, this is my attempt at that, but it's not perfect. But kind of the way that I tried to curate the soundscape to be neurodivergent cautious or friendly was by like kind of removing this emphasis that we usually have in live bands to make things like super danceable, which is super fun. I still like to do that as well. But like I'm also coming from a background in jazz, which is like a form of music that people don't like. You know?
I know a lot of people who like jazz.
Yeah, but they're old. Okay. Yeah, you know what I mean? Okay, I'm just trying to be funny. But not for real. Like it's like easy listening type of stuff. And usually, yeah, when you do live music, like you can start sets with music like that, but then there's kind of this expectation to, like, even when you're DJing, like, you slowly increase the BPM and things get, like, kind of more party-ish at the end of the night. And with this band, I specifically picked, these are all, like, guys that I've worked with before. It's actually kind of a band I used to be in, but super heavy emphasis on, like, slow, chill songs that, like, less disco, more like R&B, lo-fi. Some elements of jazz too. Everyone that's on the gig is a jazz musician. This is like, they're super excited because it's like a challenge for them because they're getting to play type of music that they don't usually get paid to play. And then probably most important factors here, instead of having live drums, I have someone on a drum pad using like electronic drum beats and auxiliary percussion, which in the space that we're doing, it's very like warehouse vibes, like concrete floor. I've seen and been in other shows there where like even if you're trying to play drums, like a drum kit quietly, it's still like super loud just because of the acoustics in that space. So that's one way. And then this key player that's on the gig, his name's Paka. So shout out to him if he's listening. He's incredible. Yeah. So jazz keyboard player. I mean, I've been on like big band gigs with him at Blue Note. So he's like a classically trained jazz pianist, but he has all these like super fun, like synthesizers, guitars. Like,
it was so good.
Yeah. He has all kinds of sounds effects, sampling. It's just, he really understood the assignment because it's just very like atmospheric, synthy, dreamy soundscape. But then like he kind of puts in this texture too when other people are soloing to just kind of like soften the sound of everything and make it really cohesive.
It's not just that they're playing the songs. The musicians are really enriching the songs with different tones. It's not exactly what you're hearing on Spotify. It's a much more fleshed out soundscape, which was the point.
So I imagine that on the spectrum of neurodivergence, there's a lot of difference. I imagine because it is a spectrum that people react differently to different stimulus. If you're playing the music and maybe there's somebody in the audience that is not responding, is there a way to adapt the music to kind of bring them into the fold?
Oh, yeah. So one of the really exciting things about this gig is I have an excellent sound person, a part of my team, who actually works here. His name is Anandev. And when we were at rehearsal, he was like checking like people's monitors, like how can we make it sound when we turn people's like the bass amp all the way off, you know, and just like he knows that like there's going to be moments during the show where we might have to modify our sound check that we had done to just accommodate the needs of the people that are there. So I feel like that's a really essential tool. That's why he's like a permanent member of any band I ever do ever again.
Yeah, I really do want to emphasize that real attention was taken to like the volumes that were like he really was paying attention. Like we turned down the snare even. Like that's a common sound that can be very, very in your face, you know, like we were really experimenting with what we could do to make it the most welcoming to neurodivergence.
I think this is a really cool event, and not just because of its inclusiveness and its aim to include people that normally don't get catered to in this way, but I think it's also a good opportunity for the public to learn about people who are neurodivergent. What would you say is the most important thing someone could learn from an event like this?
It really goes back to exactly what you said. When you go to an event, you don't think about who can't go. So I just want people to think about us more. We're not even in the thoughts.
What can you share about the event in terms of the details and what people can expect?
It's on Sunday, October 27th. You do need to sign up to participate in the painting. You can find the sign-up link in my Instagram bio. My Instagram should be somewhere on this webpage.
Yep.
You do not need to sign up to participate in the sound room. That is an experience that we just ask you to be masked for, and we are providing masks for free, but it is required for this entire event to have your mask on. That is something we want to emphasize because the overlap between neurodivergence and long COVID is undeniable. And that's another element of this that we don't want to ignore. It's a very present social issue. But the painting hours are from 5 to 8.
And then the music will start at 6. So the event will start at 5. Music will start at 6 and will go until 9.
So bring your mellow dancing shoes and a poncho. Bring your poncho. Yeah. Kelsey and Jackie, thanks so much for your time today. Appreciate being able
This was very fun.
That was Jackie Pereira and Kelsey Armstrong. They were talking to HPR's Russell Subiono about the upcoming color event here on Oahu. Full disclosure, Armstrong works as a board operator here at HPR. The event will take place on Sunday, October 27th, here on Oahu at Harbors Vintage from 5 to 9 p.m. And a reminder, masks are required to protect the health of the neurodivergent in attendance. We'll have a link to more information on our website after the show. That's it for us today. Up tomorrow, we hope to hear from a local surgeon who recently returned from war-torn Gaza. Give us some feedback. Call our talkback line at 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find the conversation as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.